Okay. So I just want to open with a story. You know, when you're holding in any particular issue, in this situation, working on parenting, you just see stories everywhere. Yesterday I witnessed a five-year-old, I'm guessing about a five- or six-year-old, and a boy and his older brother, eight or nine, were fighting over a certain object. And it was your classic argument. The little boy is the one who had it, the five-year-old, and he's trying to do whatever task he would do with it. And his older brother, running after him, trying to grab it, saying, give me it, I want it. And the little boy saying, no, I had it first. And he's like, but you don't know what you're doing, you don't know how to use it. He says, I know, but I got it first. And they're literally running in circles, playing the regular scene that you would expect a five-year-old and his eight-year-old brother to be doing. Except the only thing is that this scene was actually taking place in a cemetery. We had just finished a funeral for Gail Silverman's father, and these were the grandchildren who flew in from Minnesota. And at the end, the way that the funerals are done here, so they just fill in the cement block and then everybody leaves, and then people who stay to fill in the rest of the coffin. So everybody had gone, and there were just a few people around the open grave, and they were waiting to fill it in. The men had brought a big mound of dirt, and these two kids are running around in their usual, like over the shovel, fighting over who was going to pour the dirt. And the five-year-old thing, I got it first. And his little brother, you know how to do it. And they're circling, like they're playing with a water gun, over the open grave, trying to see who's going to throw the dirt in. And I looked at Rabbi Daichi, we were both there looking at this scene, and I said to him, you know, kids will be kids, it doesn't matter if they're literally playing over, you know, who gets the water gun next, or they're fighting over burying their grandfather. That's what you're dealing with. That's what we have, that's who they are. It was such an amazing, I don't know what to make of it, but it was just like this scene in the cemetery. That's how they go. Okay, that's just an opening. So the bottom line is, the biggest concern that I have in doing this is this, that it might appear as if by some chance I am some sort of expert in this, which I am not. I have four delicious proofs who will all be happy to share with you lots of incidents that will show you unequivocally that I am no expert whatsoever. They are all attempting to fall asleep on the back. Let it be known. So, Rifki will also be happy to point out many things, and sure she'll be here, and we'll be putting in lots of things. The idea is really just that, to share some thoughts, some techniques that I've read, seen, heard over the years, and then sort of together to create a forum to work this through, because this is one of the most important things that we do, as we all know. This is what we invest our lives in, and the more familiar with techniques and skills, the better we'll be, the more that we think about it. I have come up with so many different incidents and stories just over the last week because this is what I'm looking at, and I just see my own family and children in a different light because of that. That's how it goes. Now, I have a habit of giving a lot of introductions, which I promised myself I would not do, but I gave myself one. Before we get to the actual practical elements and the skills that I want to begin going through. That's from Rav Moshe Eisman, who was a Rebbe of mine in Baltimore. He wrote a little book called Of Parents and Penguins. And I want to share just a thought which I find to be just so important as far as this goes. He quotes a Gemara. Gemara piece in the Talmud in Erevin discusses the idea that had the Torah not been given, we would have learned certain traits, certain midos from the animal kingdom around us. And the Gemara goes through a list of the animal world and the things that we would have learned from them. The Gemara says we would have learned tznius from the chatul, we would have learned modesty from the cat, we would have learned self-sufficiency from an ant, and chastity from a dove, decency from the hen. The Gemara has a whole list of traits and behaviors that we would have learned from the animal kingdom, even if the Torah would have never been given, that's what we would have gotten. And he points out that there's one important element which is missing from the list. Obviously in a parenting class, and that would be we don't learn any parenting skills. The Gemara does not have that in part of that list. Which is odd, because if you think about what we know from the animal kingdom, there are amazing lessons that we can learn from the animal kingdom. Rashi himself quotes a couple of times how the eagle carries its young on its back, so that if anything should pierce it, it should take the wound itself and not allow anything to happen to the children. Anyone who saw Happy Feet?
Yeah.
Right, so we all know the emperor penguin travels a month time in order with its mate, with the male and the female, they travel for a month to their mating grounds. After mating, the male sits on the egg for 2 months while the female travels back, gorges herself on fish to return to feed the young, which by that time is hatched. And for 2 months, the male just sits there with this little baby with no food, out in the freezing cold. There are lots of traits of how we give. We give dedication, commitment, altruism. All of those things could be learned from the animal kingdom, and yet the Gemara doesn't have that as part of the list. That's not something that we learn. Why? The question that he raises is, why should that be? Why don't we learn any of those things from the animal kingdom? Any guesses?
Okay, we're
not hanging from that one. That's true. But then someone later should have come up with that, at least. So what he suggests, yeah?
All animals, I guess, are pretty much the same. They're children older. So you can only learn in general.
So he wants to take it in a different way. So he says as follows, when a parent in the animal kingdom does something like that, what they're expressing is the inborn nature of self-perpetuation of the species, doing that which they're trained to do in order to make sure that there's another generation. There's no personal growth in the penguin. There's no development. There's no struggle in the mother animal giving to its young. They're trained to do so inborn. That's what they have as part of their makeup. And that's the perpetuation of the species. The end is the goal of making sure the next generation is there. The means that we get there, that's what they do. And he writes, and he built a whole book upon the principle, when we parent, it's not that way. We are very much a part of the parenting perspective, meaning personally. Personal growth. We grow, we develop, we change, we struggle. As human beings, we each have our own goals, we each have our own difficulties, and the parenting process is not about just making sure that when we're done in this world, we'll have that next generation, we'll fill our places, they'll have their own families, and they'll carry on, and we'll say, we've done a good job, we're finished. That's really not true. In the Torah perspective of parenting, this is part of our own growth period, it's part of our own struggles, our own issues that we have to deal with, all of those things which come up in parenting. I don't know if you know, looking at them in terms of the age of the children, I don't know if you've ever had to apologize to your child for doing something wrong. And not just like forgetting to buy them a toy from away home. I mean like really apologize because you yelled at the kid and made the kid feel horrible, and now you need to give him a real apology. That's a task. It's so...
Before I walk out the door.
That is really humbling when you made a mistake. Not just, again, like you forgot to buy the toy on the way home and you say, oh, I'm so sorry, I'll get it tomorrow. It's not that kind of apology. But you made a mistake, you hurt the child, your child, and you have to humble yourself to really be able to apologize. That's a real growth moment of being able to do that. Most of us would much rather sort of push that aside and not have to deal with those kinds of things. I 2 weeks ago, after Shabbos afternoon, I had 20 minutes in between when the company left, and a group that I was learning with was about to come, and I just finished preparing. So I sit down on the couch with no books, no papers, hoping to sort of doze off for those 20 minutes, and my Racheli, who's 9, noticed that I didn't have anything in my hand as I sat down, and she said, do you need to prepare anything? And I gave her, which is in itself already a problem, that's how she thinks, right? You know, I'm busy preparing something. And I said, no, I just finished. In my mind, thinking, how great is this? I'm going to get 20 minutes. And she says, awesome. Can we play a game together? And you have that thought going through your mind. Oh, like, that's the last thing in the world that I want to be doing. And then, like, how long do you get where your daughter asks you to play? And there's this entire debate, which goes, I really need my rest, I really don't want it. And these are the moments in parenting. It's not about just making sure the next generation is there. These are our own personal struggles in terms of how we relate to our children. So what do you think I did? So I had a great ending to this story. So I said, of course. Now it's a question of how we say, we could say, yeah, sure. But that really, that's, you know, might as well just go to sleep if that's how we respond when our child asks us to play. So I said, yes, of course. Why don't you go pick out a game? And inside, I can't believe this is happening. But, you know, I'm trying to really get past that and enjoy the moments that I have with my daughter. As she's picking out her game, there's a knock on the door. And one of her friends shows up. And she totally forgets that I exist. And I end up asleep on the couch for 20 minutes. But that, you know, in the end, really, I lose, right, at the end of the day. But that's, those are the real-life struggles that we have, and that's part of parenting, is our own struggles and growth moments in those situations. Everybody knows that modeling is one of the greatest parts of parenting. I once had somebody who actually said to me, a guy a little younger than I am now, his first child was a girl. And he actually said this. He expressed this image. He said, "Thank God we had a girl. I am not ready to start dealing with Minion yet. I can't handle it. And I am just so thankful that we had a girl." Because he knew, and not ready to deal with it. And I'm so happy that I don't have to model that behavior yet for somebody who's going to be paying attention. Baruch Hashem, we had a girl, and I get more time to sleep in. So, anyone talk? What's that? I'm about to call them. They left me in the present. I can't believe you said that. Just heard a story today. So in some point, the parents, their child comes home, you know, with a note. The child was lying in school, and you catch the child lying at home, and so you give the child a whole schmooze about the importance of MS and telling the truth and how valuable it is. And in the middle of the schmooze, you get a phone call. So, you know, his wife took the phone and says, "You know, it's for you. It's somebody from work." And tell him I'm not home. Now we do that kind of stuff all the time without the kids, and then all of a sudden they're there, and we're trying to teach them lessons about honesty, and it really doesn't work very well when that's our natural response to the phone. And they're telling them I'm not there, and the kid's sitting there scratching his head. And okay, I got it. That's how it works. And we grow. We totally change. In other words, a person would live their whole life saying, "Tell them I'm not home," never being sensitive to the fact that they say these little white lies all over the place, until you actually have a child in the house, and now you become a little bit more sensitive and say, "Tell them I'm unavailable." That's a very small nuance, but that's what we're supposed to be doing. We don't lie. Who cares if they're children or not? We tell them I'm not available, as opposed to... Now, those are just an example of the sensitivities which we develop through the idea of having children. And what Eisen wants to point out is, it's not like the animal kingdom where it's all about just raising the next generation. We are an active part of this process and learning to become better people, more sensitive people, giving people, and how to respond to all the challenges that come up is all part of the game. And the biggest thing I'll just conclude this little hakdama, this little introduction with is, most of you who have children in this preschool should know that I know exactly what it is that you say about me regularly, because I show up to Shabbos party and I just ask, "So what's going on?" All the kids are very forthcoming with what they hear at home. They know exactly what's going on. And we learn very quickly, once our children begin speaking, that the things that we say will come out very quickly through the mouths of our children. They pick up on the tone that we use at home. They pick up on the nuances of language. They pick up on the attitudes. And without thinking, that's how they learn to speak. And there really is no greater. We learn ourselves a tremendous amount, and we grow ourselves. And I just want to stress that as we go on, that needs to be part of our regular, active, cognitive thought process. That this is really about me also. It's not just about the children. It's about how I can grow and become a better person as we go through that. Okay. Only a 14-minute introduction. I'm pretty proud of myself with that. So those who have seen this book, Love and Logic, they have Foster Klein and Jim Fay. They have Love and Logic for everything, for teaching, for teenagers, for babies, for marriage. It's a general theory that they have. They put it out there. Feel free to pick it up. They only have it in hardcover now because they redid it and the softcover hasn't come up, but I'm sure you can get it on your eBay, Craigslist, the older versions if you want. This four-part series that I want to do is really, in my mind, what I set out to do is accomplish two things. Love and Logic, while they hold themselves to be a comprehensive parenting theory, I find it most helpful for behavioral issues. How to respond to the supermarket situation, how to respond to bedtime, bath time, getting the kids dressed in the morning, all the issues that literally make us pull our hair out or at least have it turn gray, drive us crazy, send us to bed absolutely exhausted at the end of the day. This, I find, is a fantastic approach to dealing with that. And then I want to go through Faber Maglish, How to Talk so Kids Will Listen, Chaim Ginat, which is much more about developing a relationship, having in everyday interactions, skills, tools, approaches to just increasing the relationship with our children. And I always find the two go very well together. Using one without the other, I always found to be a little bit short. So I'd like to just present these things. We'll throw some other things in along the way. And you can research them yourself, look into yourself, and find what really works. And in debating which one to do first, I thought the Love and Logic for sure would be first, because, you know, developing relations with the kids is nice and all, but when you're ready to scream at them and throw them out the window because you can't get them into the bath, and that always seems to take precedence, like safety of the children. So we'll We'll start with this. I want to just we'll share some thoughts of that, and then we'll move into some of the other things. I know anyone here familiar with either read it or heard different lectures from Love and Logic? Just to get a sense, I know that you have. Yes? No?
Familiar.
A little bit?
I mean, familiar with the concepts and separate.
So, in any case, whether you are or you're not, certainly if you are, and even if you're not, one of the great things about these things are review. Both, I find, marriage and parenting are two things that one can review daily, not weekly, and certainly monthly. And if you've heard them, if you hear them 1,000 times, we seem to forget from one day to the next. Our children and our spouses are continuously and constantly giving us more opportunities to review and to go over and to improve on things which we did. So for those who are familiar or not, so we could always develop it. Okay, what is it that at the end of the day we want from our children? At the end of the day, when we're all finished and all is said and done, what is it that we desire, that we yearn for them to have? So without spending time going around the room and having everybody put their suggestions, we really want them to be independent, living on their own, responsible people who know how to make wise decisions in life. At the end of the day, we don't want them living in our basement when they're 35. We would not consider ourselves successful parents if they have not been able to go out and make a life for themselves. So Hashem, they should get married, raise their own families, want them to be independent, want them to be responsible, want them to make decisions, understand the consequences of their actions, and to be able to take that responsibility at a young age. My Rena tonight, who's almost 15 months, 16 months, that's close. So tonight, she was learning how to climb onto the couch. She was just about there, sitting there on the top of the couch. She noticed that everyone likes to play on top of the couch, and she's struggling to get on. And I'm sitting right next to her as she's struggling on. She's really just there, and every time that she just about gets on, she looks up at me and kicks up her arms and sort of, you know, pats the couch. What's the worst thing that I could do at that time? Pick her up. I could pick her up. Yeah. I mean, for that little moment of dealing with her. I mean, I could do other things. I could throw her down. That's true. Why is picking her up so bad?
You're not showing her that she's
doing it. Right? Obviously, because she's going to figure it out on her own. And in fact, 10 minutes later, she did. And then she's fine for the rest of the night. Now it takes her 2 seconds, and she's up there. Had I picked her up and I did it the next time, I really just robbed her of the opportunity to learn how to figure out how to do it herself. Very obvious, simple example, yet in our own parenting with our children, we are constantly doing that, in which as the child has an opportunity to learn on their own, we often take that away from them and don't allow them the opportunity to do so. The reality is, in our own adult lives, it's the same thing. I will probably very rarely leave my house during the winter without gloves in my pockets. I will always check to know whether or not they're there, for a very simple reason. Because once I forgot them, and my fingers froze off. And I had very sensitive fingers, and the cuts that I had all over my fingers lasted a week. So I always check before going to make sure that I have my gloves. We learn from our experiences, that's the greatest way to learn. Chazal say that we learn the road of wisdom is paved with mistakes. Chazal say, Sheva yipol tzadik, a tzadik will fall 7 times, and each time he gets up, it's only through the mistakes that we make we learn. I'm going on a trip tomorrow to New York. I will make sure that I pack our easy pass, which we have from our days in Baltimore, because one time I forgot it, I have to wait at every single toll for the entire trip, the extra 20 minutes to go and pay your toll, as opposed to having your easy pass. You make that mistake once, and then you get it. But we rob our children of those opportunities to be able to do that also. And children are scientists. They are the greatest explorers that's out there. They want to know everything about the world around them. They want to learn, they want to find out what's going on, they want to do that. And the goal that we want to do is let them be in the arena and figure that out, especially while the stakes are low, while when they make their mistakes, the price that they pay is relatively low. They'll learn it, and then they begin to adapt and learn the process of this is what life is like. There are choices to be made, and I have consequences on my choices. In Torah Judaism, the principle of all of life is what we call bechira. We have free choice. We make decisions. And we have to accept the responsibility for the choices that we make. And the earlier that our children have an ability to begin to learn that, so the better that it is for them. For example, I don't know if anyone's begun playing card games with your children, or if you begin to get old board games, whatever it may be. So children have this wonderful knack, as young children, of not really being good sports. The sort of natural part of being a 3-year-old. They like to win. As adults, we also like to win. Sometimes they like to cheat, and sometimes they like to play with attitude. Ever experienced any of that with any of the children? If you haven't, there's a show that if you get a little bit older, you will have such a wonderful opportunity. Okay?
Nothing.
No, what was it?
I said, or with your
spouse. Or with your spouse. Now, so how do we make sure that we don't end up with a child who will become a spouse who will still be that same, that four still plays with the attitude, doesn't know how to lose, and doesn't know how to share? So what happens is when you're a child, you let that develop. Now, as a parent, when I'm playing a card game with a child and the child either cheats or has a horrible attitude that I see, if this child continues this, when they're playing with their friends aren't going to tolerate that. Their friends are going to say, you know, we really don't like playing with you. And now you have to deal with all the situation of this poor child sitting at home, he doesn't have any friends, and blah, blah, blah. Because you had an opportunity when the stakes were low, it's just you and the child, to teach the child that, well, when you play like that, or when you talk to me like that, I'm really not interested with playing with you, and you can walk away and end the game, game over, because you don't play nicely, I'm not interested in playing. And we could begin the idea of training that's an easy lesson to learn, because you're going to play again tomorrow, you're going to play again in an hour. But that we begin that process. So just to continue this example, let's talk about brushing teeth. Let's go to our favorite time of day. You brush. Anyone ever fight with their children over brushing their teeth? You just give up? So if your children like brushing your teeth, you are blessed. Most of us do not. So the love and logic principle is basically as follows. The love is as follows. Set loving guidelines, loving principles, love them enough to allow them to make mistakes and let the logic of their natural consequence teach them. Instead of punishments teaching, which punishments usually don't work, yelling and screaming doesn't work, let the natural consequences do the teachings. I want to go through this. Let's just work through this example. So why do our children have to brush their teeth at night? Right? They don't get cat litter. Everybody knows that. So now, that's not a task that children particularly enjoy, generally. And if you think about it, I always think about, like, usually, you know, we used to let the children brush their teeth, and they all got cavities anyway, because they don't know how to brush their teeth really well. So we sort of have to do it for them. Okay, it's not pleasant to have an adult stand over you, you know, prying your mouth over it and, like, shoving it. It's not a pleasant experience. I don't blame the children for not necessarily liking the experience of brushing teeth. But nonetheless, it's something that they need to do. That's not an option. You have to brush your teeth. So we take it upon ourselves as parents we're going to administer this punishment to them. We're going to administer this concept of having to brush your teeth. And it becomes a battle in many homes. Going over this process of getting them and leaving us extremely exhausted at the end, as we have this four-year-old. We're already tired at the end of the day. They're at their wits' end. They're ready to go to bed. We engage in this battle. So, what else is out there, says love and logic, other than doing this? So the first step, and this again, we'll just take this example, we'll play a bunch of different examples, is to get rid of the four most ineffective methods for getting your children to do anything. First most ineffective method is getting angry. We all know, how do we react when someone gets angry with us? We usually don't do exactly what it is that they say. That's usually not our first response. We have a tremendous amount of resistance to anyone when they get angry. We all know if we were to switch this to a marriage workshop for a second, when you're angry, very little is going to be accomplished. First of all, because we say the weirdest things when we're angry to children. If you've ever had a chance to pay attention to the words that come out of our mouth when we are angry with our children, listen to other people when they speak to their children when they're angry. You can't even believe that somebody would say that to a child, especially to their own child, but to any person. So anger is not going to work. That doesn't need much explanation. That's not going to work. The second most ineffective method of getting a child is what we call the threat. We like to threaten our children. If you don't brush your teeth now, and you know, you can come up with whatever good things that we normally come up with. What does that usually invite a child to do? We test the limits. I mean, what do we do in our own jobs? Whenever we get anything like that, we always test the limits of what really are the rules of the workplace. What really does my boss care about, and what does he really not care about so much? What can I get away with? So when you start making threats, it's an invitation to the child to see whether or not you're going to carry through the threat, and especially if the threat is not enforceable, because we come up with things like you'll never get a piece of gum again for the rest of your life kind of stuff. So children particularly enjoy the threats. Or we like to employ warnings. Warnings are maybe we count. We like to count to three. Counting is good because sometimes you can't ever get to three because you're going to be in trouble. Now what? I just got to three and the child's nowhere near here and shows no sign of coming anywhere near here. So this is, by the way, how the decimal system was invented. It was some counter who came up with 2.1 and 2.2 and 2.3. Maybe if you've done it before, you found it effective. I generally have not found it effective in any way, shape, or form. Through warning, this is your first warning, this is your second warning, and this is your third warning, and then it ends up leading to some form of punishment which doesn't have any impact on the child as well. And the last thing, which for most of you who have younger children, you don't eventually do, but you know, lecturing the children is also a great, you can explain to them why it's so important that they need to be brushing their teeth and cavities, and you can explain to them how much it costs to fill the cavities and why it's so important, because they're not going to be able to go to college if you have to pay for the dental work when they're four. You can try that method and let me know if that works with your 4-year-old as well. But if you take away if you take away the ability that you can't threaten the child at all and you can't lecture the child, there's no warning system, there's no getting angry, that you're going to be absolutely calm and in control entirely over this little mini battleground that's going on in your home at night about brushing the teeth, what really do you have left to be able to do that? Well, the greatest thing, says Love and Logic, is the natural consequence. And this is where our own parenting skill will come in. This example is a rather straightforward example. What happens if you were to say instead, make an announcement, the child has now been bathed, in their pajamas in the room, make an announcement, I'm heading into the bathroom, it's time to brush your teeth, I'm happy to help you now. You head up into the bathroom and you wait. Now, most likely what's going to happen is you'll be waiting there by yourself. Because most children, maybe if you have children like brushing their teeth is one thing, I don't have any of those that breed, things that come out that way, really don't enjoy particularly brushing the teeth. They'd rather be busy in the room playing. So you wait whatever the designated amount of time would be for your age child, 4-year-old child, you wait 3 minutes, 4 minutes, whatever it is for the child to come on their own to brush their teeth, and the child doesn't come. Not a problem, end of the story. We move on to the next part of the evening, which would be, brushing teeth, reading a book, going to bed. We'll just skip the brushing teeth part, and we'll start with reading a book. Now when you take your child and put him into bed and start reading a book, totally calm, not angry at all, totally in control of the situation, this child will be thinking, most likely, one of two things. Either the child will say, trying to push off bedtime a little bit later, because it's always right when you get into bed, wait a minute, we didn't brush my teeth yet. And then they'll be ready to come up with the idea of, now it's time to brush your teeth. The only time my children have ever on their own volunteered to brush their teeth has been in that situation where we've forgotten, and they're in bed, and then all of a sudden 20 minutes later they'll come out. Can you believe it? They somehow remember we didn't brush their teeth, and they're marching out, and one of them hears that the other one didn't. Now it's the part we forgot to brush teeth. So it's on the occasions where we've forgotten to brush their teeth, they somehow miraculously remember while they're lying in bed, they're going through the course of events of their day, I'm sure they're reviewing it, they remember they didn't brush their teeth. So your child will either do that, will be in bed as he begins reading, will say he didn't brush your teeth, or they'll think that they've just won this battle. They'll be, yes, we just got away without brushing teeth. Either one of those two scenarios is totally fine. If a child is ready to brush their teeth, you give them I'm so sorry. We're finished brushing teeth time. A lot of sorry feelings. It's so sad. I know you would have liked to have brushed your teeth because I see you're asking me you'd like to do that right now. We're done. We're moving on. It's now time to read books and we're going to go to bed. And there's no brushing teeth for the evening. Now, the assumption that I'm making here is that everybody's okay with their children not going to sleep for a night without brushing their teeth. If there are any dentists here or people who are otherwise, then we'll switch examples. But just playing along for this for the moment. And then that's it. Continue on. Let's assume the rest goes fine because we're going to focus on one variable at a time. Read books, go to bed, everything is great. Well, we all know, why do we have to brush our children's teeth at night? It's because we need to make sure that they don't get cavities. What is the greatest cavity-inducing food out there? Sugar and snacks, the stuff that they really like to have put into their lunch when they go to school, or if you don't give them snacks when they come home from school, they like to have their snacks. Well, what do you do with a child who you can't trust to brush their teeth at night? Because you're not really sure you're going to be able to do it. It wouldn't be right to give a child like that sugar, because I'm not convinced that we're going to be able to brush our teeth at night, and I can't give you sugar knowing that later at night, we're not going to be able to brush our teeth. So a child comes home from school and didn't get a snack. Usually he gets his, whatever it may be in his lunch, he gets his pudding or his cookie, or if he's done with healthy food, he comes home, he likes to have ice cream when he comes back. Or if you don't do that, you simply create the situation in which you head off to get some ice cream after school, and everybody gets except for Mr. Four-Year-Old, who is screaming he wants his ice cream, and you say with so much sadness in your voice, "Oh, I'm so sorry, I want to give you ice cream. And I can't even do it. I try not to do this because it's so hard to do it for real." And that is the key component that you really have to do it. That's where the practice comes in. But let's assume I'm really good at it. It is. But it really is. It's a matter of thinking. The perspective that we have is, I am training my child to recognize he's going to make decisions, and they're consequent. And they're now. If you were, let's just take a pause there. If you were to say, when you got into his room after he didn't come to brush his teeth, you were to say, "You didn't brush your teeth, we're not reading a book." What does that have to do with anything? That's a punishment. It's just, they're unrelated. The fact that you didn't brush your teeth, why do I not get a book? So I didn't brush my teeth. Now the child is just learning that there are these punishments out there, and what do we always do when we're punished and we can't really connect the reason why we're suffering this punishment to our behaviors? We just really resent that. And we don't learn that next time what we need to do is brush our teeth. We learn to figure out how to get back at the parents or the boss or whoever it was that levied this unfair and unjust punishment. How do we get back? But if I'm not giving you a punishment, I'm so sorry, I want to give you ice cream, but you see, we don't brush our, we're having trouble brushing our teeth, and since ice cream is one of the major, you don't want to give a whole lecture on sugar, but ice cream, if you eat a lot of sugar and you don't brush your teeth, you're going to get a lot of cavities. I don't want you to get cavities, so I can't give you ice cream until I see that we can brush our teeth at night. Now you're going to have a screaming fit, but we'll put that on hold for a moment.
I was going to say, now you've got situation number two.
100%, and we'll deal with that. 100%. But right now, what we just did is, you didn't brush your teeth at night, that's fine, that doesn't bother me at night, I'm totally okay with that, because tomorrow, there's going to be a very natural consequence to the fact that you didn't brush your teeth. I can't give you a snack because you don't want to brush your teeth. Well, you can be rest assured that even your four-year-old, who sometimes seems to forget lots of things, come that evening, after bath time, when you call out, "It's time to brush our teeth," you're going to have a child march into the bathroom. And if he doesn't, not a problem at all, because it usually doesn't take more than two or three times, and if it doesn't work, you just switch whatever it is. If your child isn't into the ice cream, it's just a matter of, that's where the work comes in, is finding a very natural consequence for what it is that the child doesn't want to do on their own. Child doesn't want to brush your teeth, it doesn't bother me. Whose problem is it that the child doesn't want to brush your teeth? It's going to become the child's problem. I am not going to spend my life running after, cajoling, fighting with a child to brush their teeth. This doesn't need to be this way. You're old enough to come on your own, and if you don't want to, that's not a problem. We'll find a very natural response to that which it is.
Let's go for a bedtime.
Yeah, no, let's go through, so it's bedtime. So in other words, so in each situation, you take each child differently. Whether or not, what is the, what it is that the child would enjoy, what would make sense for any particular routine. So for a lot of children, like to have books, or like to tell stories, like to do stuff, and it's our job almost sometimes to create the scenario that they really want to be able to get. So if you like reading books with your children, it's a matter of where, if bedtime took a little bit of extra time, when you get them into bed. And again, there's just lots of different scenarios. Well, let's just play, let's say you get into bed, and then they want to read a book. It's that same, you have to lock in that empathy. That's really the tough part, and that is the key to it, in which you are really saddened because I really want to read you a book. The problem is that that time is at 7, and now it's already 7:05, and we don't have time to do that anymore. I hope tomorrow we'll be able to read a book, because I really love reading a book to you. If you can get past the sarcasm and the feeling of, which I have a lot of difficulty, and the reason why when I do this, it doesn't work, it's because I'm so angry that I have to go through this, and it comes out in the way that I'm not really empathic with them. I'm not really saying, "Oh, I don't." I'm just like, "It's too late. We're not reading tonight." That doesn't work. The whole point is that I'm on your side. I want to read this book to you. It's just that it's too late. I called you to bed 10 minutes ago. We would have had time, and now we don't. I think tonight, just tonight, I have two older boys. We finish supper at 6, and they go to bed at 7 to 7:30. At 6 o'clock, for the first time ever, my two boys, right after they finished supper, said, "Can I take a shower now?" I said, "Can you take a shower?" He said, "Yeah, can we? I said, yeah. Off they march, and they went to take a shower. Two older ones. They finished to get dressed, and they come out with a football in their hand, and they had started playing this tackle football game they made up in the playroom before bedtime, but they almost never have more than time than 3 minutes, because Ephraim, the younger one, by the time he finished with it, he doesn't have much time, and I'm always pulling him out, because there wasn't enough time. You can play for a few minutes, you can either read a book for the 3 minutes, you can play your game, he usually chooses to play for his 3 minutes, and then in the middle of the game, he gets picked up and whisked away. And they chap, well, if we shower earlier, we'll have more time to play before that 7 o'clock hits. And they on their own, this is not after one or two nights, this is after like months of this is how it works. This is the time that you have, however you want to spend it, but then time's up and you lose. They on their own tonight decided to shower at 6 because they had something else that they would rather do. And they went ahead and took care of that so they can get done what they wanted to do. That was this interesting moment where you're like, well, that means they learned the concept of their decisions, consequences. They make decisions. They're in control, and they do however it is that they want to do it. Now, I'll take another pause for a second, and that is, even if they don't learn at all what we want them to learn, which very often happens, what this does, and we'll get, there's a lot more to go through, is it gives us, as parents, an approach. I know what I'm going to do when my child won't brush their teeth. When I'm in carpool line and my child won't get in the car or won't get into his car seat, and I'm sitting there and I got 10 cars behind me and I have a screaming baby and my 4-year-old will not get into his seat, I'm not going to get flustered because I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to pull forward so I can get out of the way, and then I'm going to wait for the child to do it. And then I'm all of a sudden going to want to get ice cream. Except we're not going to have time to do that. Or I'm going to all of a sudden want to do whatever it is that we were about to do. And often you have to create a consequence that makes sense, that because we were about to do this, but we didn't have time because it took too much to do here. Or I'm now too tired to do whatever it was that I was going to do. Very often, it's pretty easy. We actually were about to do that. Sometimes you need to be a little bit creative, and that's really where the work of parenting comes in. I've found even when you're, if you're working through this and you're still good about it, and we go through this, and we are coming up with something that makes sense to fit what it is that's going on, isn't always a no-brainer. It often takes a lot of creative energy to come up with something that makes sense, that because of whatever it was the child just did, this is what's going to happen because of that. But if you're deciding not to get into your car seat, and you're 4 years old, and you know how to get into your car seat, who's going to lose because of that? It's going to be you.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
The only thing that concerns me about this approach is that it seems to be that, especially in a situation where you're setting up something like, making something up, like, oh, gee, we were going to go to Target and go shopping for new toys, but since you didn't get in your seat, is that then teaching them now, I mean, getting in your car seat, they shouldn't be rewarded for that. That should just be something that they have to do.
Right.
And I know from personal experience that my son, if I tell him, oh, if I tried that on him, he would then turn around and, like, every day that he got into his car seat, he'd say, like, okay, look, I got into my car seat, let's go. And I'm not going to take him to ice cream every day because he got into his car seat, or take him to Target every day,
100%.
Or whatever. And so I'm afraid that I'm setting them up for I don't always give them a treat in their lunch. And if I were to use the thing with the brushing the teeth, well, oh, gee, I can't give you a treat in your lunch.
Well, 100%. And each child's situation is different in that, in which hopefully you don't always need to actually make up a situation. That's sometimes hopefully a last resort. It's most likely that from the time that you pick him up at 1 or at 3, whatever time it is, until he goes to sleep at 7, there is something that he would have liked for you to have been able to do for him, that you're no longer going to have the energy or the time to do because it took so much out of you getting him home.
So does it have to be like direct? So I could make it so that it's not even necessarily something that is in like immediate. Like if it was going to be, oh, we were going to go for
children,
it can be, you know, at 5 or 6. Oh,
yeah.
You want to go outside and ride your bike? You know what?
I'm just so tired. It has to be reasonable to the child. Otherwise, you lose the impact. But children remember. You know, if you ever promise your child a toy, let's say for his afikoman present, and 3 months later he comes to you and says, hey, whatever happened, they remember those kinds of things. So to say that if it's not immediate, the child won't be able to connect it, I haven't found in my experience that that's true. They're very good at remembering things that they want to. The trick is making it reasonable, that it makes sense, that because you're so frazzled because you have a screaming baby and you took so long to get in the car seat, I'm zonked. I don't have the energy that I had, that I would have liked to have had to spend on this. That makes sense. Now that's where the work comes in terms of making that make sense.
But when you use this method, do you tell them, let's say when it took 10 minutes for them to get in the car seat, and then they get in the car seat, do you say, well, I was going to read you a book tonight, or when it comes time to read the book at night, do you bring it up? Or like whenever?
Yeah, no, only later, right, no, because I listen to these threats and these warnings.
Okay.
You're saying that later you're now...
Like with the ice cream thing.
Yeah.
Like when they would get in their car seat, you would say, we were going to go to ice cream, but now I'm not going to bring you, because it's something that, you know, a direct consequence.
Right.
But then if you're using, like, something later on in the day, it might not. It seems like...
Yeah, I mean, I
you're taking the ice cream before school.
I'm not an expert. I mean, in terms of like this, I don't know. You could try things. You know, every day you'll have another opportunity in something else. If it doesn't work, so tomorrow it won't be the car seat. It'll be getting dressed in the morning. And there are ways in which. Let me introduce one more thing. Let's just do one more thing, and then we'll. You know, there are different aspects of that. okay.
It's just another example with homework, and I was curious about that. So
the general, that's just a basic introduction. The rules are, they've in their love and logic, they basically set up two rules. In the setting of the first thing that you need to do is set up a firm, enforceable limit. Either the limits of the house, the rules of the house, the procedures of the house, not in the sense of, these are the things that you must do, these are the rules in the house. Classic example, let's say you just bought a new computer. And so you have the children are either not allowed to go play on that computer, or they have their own computer. Simply say, rules, just wanted to state the procedure, computers are not for touching. Now it's very clear, why do you say it that way as opposed to say, don't touch the computer? Because when you say, don't touch the computer, all that you're doing is inviting them to figure out, there's no need to engage in a battle just in simply laying down the procedure. Babies are not for touching. The computer is not for touching. Living rooms are not for playing ball in. Simply stating the procedure, and then you basically sit back and wait for the child to violate the rule. And I don't say that in a joking way. I mean that very, very seriously. The goal of this is, life is about learning. There are rules. I want my child to test the limits, because I want them to know that the limits are there, and that they are real, and that I mean it, and that when I say something, it's real. It's a form of torture to a child. There are two major forms of torture that we do to our children regularly, and that if we would step back and think about what we're doing, are really torturous behavior. One is when we say to them, Chaim, come here. And then he doesn't come. And then nothing happens to him. And then we say, Chaim, come here. I called you 2 times already. And you just continue sitting there, and you never... And then eventually, maybe you get up and pick him up, and now you're all angry. But you said it 4 times. After you said it the first time, and nothing happened, what have you taught your child is the value of your word when you ask them to do something? Meaningless. And then all of a sudden, the 4th time, now you get up, and you're all angry at him. And he doesn't understand. 3 times you call me, nothing happened. How is he supposed to know when, now I mean it. So, I'll tell you how he knows. When you lose it, he comes. What have you trained him? What have you trained the child? When I talk to you like a human being, I don't really need it. But when I lose it, and I start screaming, or I get up with that look in my eye that says, I'm going to pound you, then the child knows this is serious. Now, that's what we teach them. And they're not doing anything wrong. They're just trying to learn the world around them. And they're supposed to figure it out. Because every child at 3 years old, when they're playing in the playroom with their ball, and you say, dinner time... They're not going to come running. Yes, dinner time. Great. That's what they're going to do. And then you say, dinner time. So they learn through their normal childlike behavior in the playroom that it's when you start yelling and screaming and threatening that, dinner time. Now they come. Now that's a form of torture to a child not to know when you really mean what you say and when you don't mean what you say. How are they supposed to know? How do they learn? The other thing that we do is that we are inconsistent when they make requests and giving in to when what they want. They make they ask for a dessert and you say no, and they ask for dessert and you say no, and then eventually you say yes. Torture. Anybody ever play with slot machines? Okay, you can admit it. Okay. Slot machines, the way that they work is you push this thing down, you put in your dollar, and then the thing comes. Now, there's a real thing called gambling addiction that's out there, and slot machines particularly are very susceptible. People who have a leaning towards a gambling addiction are going to get hooked on slot machines. And there's a very simple reason for that. How do slot machines work? You do the same thing over and over again. All you do is you put in your dollar and pull the handle, and you wait to see when it's going to come up a winner. Now, it's programmed beforehand. There's a certain, every once in a while, you're going to win. And you hear people winning all around you, but you never know when you are going to win. And you can never stop because maybe the next time. If I stop now, the person after me, on their first one, they're going to win. I can't stop because maybe it's the next one. And you know that eventually you are going to win. You know it. It's a fact. Every slot machine will eventually win. But how do you ever stop when you know there's a point out there that you'll get it? You don't know how much you win, but you know you win something. And you'll never be willing to stop because it's always what's always irking you is, I only did it one more time. One more time I would have won. And you go ahead, you'll go away, it'll rip you out because I lost $1,000. If I would have done it one more time, I would have won. I mean, those are the gamblers. Then they lose 2,000 and 3,000 and 4,000. Then they win 500. And then they're, that's how it works. So what happens when your child says, I want a cookie for dessert? And you say, it's 4:30 and you're serving supper in an hour. I want a cookie. You say, no, not right now. We're serving supper in an hour. I want a cookie. Not right now. And they do it 10 times. And you eventually lose it and you say, fine, here's a cookie. Leave me alone. What if you just taught the child? Well, if you ask enough, and you're persistent enough, and you're annoying enough, you will eventually get a cookie. Now, have we helped ourselves or hurt ourselves in the long run? We've done horrible damage. I don't mean that this is a form of child abuse in a real sense, because what you've done is you've taught the child to become a whiner who thinks that the way the world works is that if you ask enough times, in enough different ways, in enough different settings, in an annoying enough voice, you'll eventually get it. And when you tell the child to finally stop, he has that same problem that the gambler has. But if I only would have asked one more time, I would have gotten it. Because that's what happened last time. Eventually, I got it. And we do these things and we're training our children not to take our words seriously. When we say, it's time for dinner, they don't take us seriously because we're not yelling and screaming yet. We're just talking to them like normal human beings. And they know, when we talk like normal human beings, we don't really mean what we say. And then they sometimes, we teach them, and when they ask things of us, and we say, no, 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 and then eventually we give in, all that we've done is we've taught them that's how the world works. Keep going. Be persistent. Persistence pays off and eventually you get what you want. The problem is you never know when it will be. And they now walk around the world very uneasy and you see very uncomfortable because they never know when they'll get what they want, how many times they have to ask, and when their parents mean anything. Because there is no solid walls around them. Children crave structure. They crave rules. They crave knowing. Anyone would. If you suddenly, were born into this world and you couldn't see or you're in a situation, all that you want to know is you want to walk around you and figure out how the room around you is set up, how it works. If every time you went over to a wall, it was one way, and then you went back again 5 minutes later and it moved, you'd be very uneasy walking around the room not knowing what it is that you're ever going to get. The greatest gift that we can give our children is being solid, consistent in the limitations that we put in. We set up a rule, and if you violate the rule, there will be a consequence. Not as harsh punishment, but that the rule means something. My words, when I call you for dinner, dinner time is a great example. Kids are playing in the playroom. Dinner is on the table. Make sure everybody here, everybody, they're on the table. Great. Guess who comes into the kitchen? Nobody. Rifkin and I sit down and we have a lovely, quiet dinner together. Rather enjoyable. 20 minutes go by, dinner is cleared off of the table, and we're into bath time. Well, guess who's very hungry? Guess who's not eating dinner tonight? Now, this is where love and logic can be a little bit harsh, but my kids will still tell you about the time that they went to bed without dinner because they didn't come into the the kitchen when dinner was called. Now they've learned, like all the children, to test limits, and they come in exactly 15 minutes after we call dinner, so that once they have a rule, like once you got started, then you're not going to pull a plate away from them. But they know, they, my Ephraim will remember the time we went to sleep without getting to eat dinner? Yeah, because dinner was called. Welcome to come and join us. Dinner is served, and then dinner is no longer served. And this, whether they learned that lesson or not, is a machayah, because as a parent, one of the most stressful things in the world is dinner's on the table and trying to get your kid in to eat. And it's become like it's our mission in life that they should eat. Children will be fine if they don't eat for a night. What's more important is if they learn, this is how things work. Dinner is served now. You're welcome to join us. Happy to have you. But it's not served for the next hour when you feel like coming in, so that we are totally frazzled and stressed out fighting with children to come in. You don't like what's for supper? Yuck. No problem. Breakfast is served at 7 o'clock tomorrow morning. This is what's for dinner tonight. You don't have to eat it if you don't like it. And this is not a restaurant. And whatever you feel is appropriate, whether or not you get one choice or two choices, whatever it is, this is what's for dinner. Your choice. You don't have to eat it if you don't like to. The goal is to place the responsibility into the hands of the child, that it is their decision to make. So rounding out, one of the examples we spoke about is the theater. So you say to a child, and this is going to be most probably for a lot of the younger children as well, computers are not for touching. This is daddy's new computer, computers are not for touching. Sit back and pretend to read a book on the couch, because you know if your child is worth keeping, and all of your children are worth keeping, you know that what your child is going to do is work his way or her way over to the computer to check it out. That's what they're going to do. And that's what you hope that they'll do. Because there was a new policy set in the house. Computers are not for touching. And you just wait for them to touch it. And as soon as they touch it, what happens to them? So in Love and Logic, they have what they call the uh-oh song. For those who have heard it. And it works well for younger children. 2 to 4, I would say. After that, you make a small adjustment. And simply, uh-oh, I see you're not ready to be in the playroom with the rest of us. Or, uh-oh, I see you're not ready to behave with the other children. I see you're not ready to be nice. Whatever the situation that it was, you have chosen to do whatever that you've done, which is against whatever positive. I see you're not ready. Why don't we spend a few minutes in your room until you're ready to come out? Now, for really young children, if like a 2-year-old who's not going to come out on their own, there's like a certain type of child will do that, then you can go back in five minutes later and say, are you ready to come back out and be sweet? Are you ready to come back out and play with everybody? Are you ready to be with your siblings? For children like my 5-year-old, I'm not going to fight with him over the door because he's going to come back out. Right when I put him in, I right away put the choice on him and say, whenever you're ready to come back out and join us, please do. So that when he's going to be out before I even get down the hall when he's going to be out, and then I can say, oh, I'm so glad you've decided to come back out and join us. I'm not punishing you. You weren't ready to be with us. No problem. You'll spend some time getting yourself together again. When you're ready to come back out, feel free to come back out and join us. Whenever it is that you're ready. And then I make a big deal over the fact that he's back out and say, I'm so glad I see that you've decided that you're ready to behave sweetly. I'm so glad that you're back here. No anger. It's just, that was the rule. He'll do it again. Come right back over. Probably touch the computer 5 minutes later. And the considering, I'm so sorry that you decided you weren't ready to be in the playroom with us, and right back in, and knowing that it's going to be straight back on that, when you're ready to come back out, when you've decided you're ready to join us, we'll be so excited to have you back with us. Child throws food at the table, plays with his food, does whatever. I'm so sorry you're not ready to sit at the table with us. You're welcome to play on the floor. Remove the table. He's not ready to eat. I can't force my child to eat. I can't force my child to behave. I can control where they do it. You're not ready to sit at the table with us. That's not a problem. You can go into the playroom. You don't want to eat tonight. I'm not going to force you to eat. This is when dinner is served. 20 minutes later, dinner is over, and that's the end of the story. And then you'll have to deal with the after dinner moment of the child being hungry. But that we can handle already, because we'll be good at that. The other thing about another example of this is kvetching. Any of you ever had a child who like just kvetches in the kitchen incessantly? You know what I'm talking about? Yeah. So we've created in this house a kvetch room. I cannot control whether or not my child kvetches. Can't do it. There's nothing in my power that can control whether or not my 4-year-old is going to kvetch incessantly over, you name it. I can control where he'll do it. And when there's kvetching in the kitchen, Children know the rules are there's no fetching in the kitchen. You want to fetch? Great. Let me show you. I'll escort you to the fetch room. And I take him with me. And go into one of the bedrooms. It's usually the boys' room. And they know this is the fetch room. And I said, would you like me? And I offer to join them in the fetch room because it's a lot more fun. They usually, and I join them in the fetch room and I start fetching. Hey there, what's up? And I usually, the first time I did it, I mean, it took about a second for he was on the floor laughing. And he's not interested in fetching in his room. Forget about by himself, he's not interested in doing it with me. Like, now it's permission to fetch, so we're there, we hang out there for about usually 30 seconds, and he's totally over it. And then I as soon as I put him in, I bring him to the room, it's the same thing. When you're finished kvetching, I would love to have you back in the kitchen whenever you're done. Would you like me to stay here and kvetch with you for a little bit? Because I would like to do that. And I sit down, and I start kvetching, and he's done in a second. Then he takes off. And as soon as I get back to the kitchen, he's already done. I'm like, I'm so glad you've decided to stop kvetching. It's at the point now where I don't even get from there to here, and he's cracking up. Because it's just too funny to have me kvetching with him in the kvetch room. But that's totally fine. Whether he does or doesn't do it, I'm not going to stop you from kvetching. I can't. But you can't do it in my house, in my kitchen. You want to kvetch? Your choice. Would you like me to carry you to the kvetch room, or would you like to walk yourself? Now, if you don't get a response to that, what decision does that mean you made?
Carry.
He wants to be carried. No problem. I'm not angry at you. You want to kvetch? I understand. I sometimes want to kvetch also. Pick him up. We go to the kvetch room, and I'll sit with him and kvetch. And then I put it on his head, when you're ready to come back out and join us, I am so excited to have you, and I can't wait until you do so, whenever you're ready. Which usually takes a very short period of time before the child is ready to do so. Okay, yeah.
But meanwhile, you haven't had your dinner. I'm just giving an example. And then you're hungry and cranky, or... you're cutting off your... It seems to me, like, when I've tried to do things like this, and that's part of the reason I haven't been consistent over time, is I end up cutting off my nose to spite my face. And it's a problem. So I don't know, like, what's the balance there?
I'm going to add on to that.
Yeah.
Like, this always seems to happen to me. My kids can entertain themselves and can be off doing their own things. The minute the phone rings and I need to talk to somebody on the phone... is when all of a sudden they start fetching and they want my attention. Mommy, 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 mommy. And, you know, I can't, every time I pick up the phone, put down the phone and go with them, either take them off or carry them off or send them off to the room and or go with them. Like, what she's saying, like,
yeah.
It interrupts whatever you're doing. Whatever you're trying to accomplish, you can't accomplish.
100%. This is where, like, that's why there is no perfect model.
Mm-hmm.
There's like a theory, and then you learn to adapt and apply it. So let's work through that example. Right? Your phone's ringing, you got dinner on the stove, phone rings, and you need to take the phone, and all of a sudden everybody wants a drink. Or everybody wants you to do whatever it is they want. Perfect example. Now, I can't deal with the children right now because I need to deal with whatever it is that I'm dealing with. Now let me just preface this with, we've also trained our children to fear the phone. Because what do we usually say to our children when we're on the phone?
Just a minute.
Right. How long does it usually take before we're off?
Already.
How long does it take before we're off?
20.
Exactly. You hear this? It's usually about 20 minutes. On average, our conversation will be 15 to 20 minutes, and we've told our child, 1 second. Now, do they know that when we say 1 second, like what does exactly 1 second mean? I mean, so they eventually learn whenever they get a sense of time, it doesn't mean 1 second. It means some undetermined amount of time before mommy decides to get off the phone. But we say the same thing every time. We say, I'll be with you in 1 second. I'll be with you in a minute. And then the child learns. He never or she never knows when he'll get your attention again. There is no sense of, I'm consistent in my response, I need to take care of this. Now, I don't have a great response to that because sometimes conversations take 5 minutes, sometimes they take 10, and sometimes they take 20. And we don't often know as the phone rings and we get on the phone how long it will be. And that's the balance that we need to learn to strike. But I'm just pointing out that in the way that we respond to our children, sometimes the reason why they get so crutchy when the phone rings is because you've now entered into this twilight zone and they don't know when they're going to get you again. And when they ask for things, sometimes we can multitask and we can pour them a glass of juice while I'm on the phone, and sometimes we just can't handle whatever it is that they want to do. So there's another area we just need to be sensitive to the way that we respond to them when we're on the phone and it is that they need us. But let's say they're kvetching and you're not able to pick them up and take them to the room and go through the whole thing.
Right, you're making something on the stove and you just can't leave it, it's going to burn, you what do you do?
So if you can't leave it, let's a simpler case is where you don't have something on the stove is you leave. You go into your room, close the door behind you, and go into your bed. Like however many steps away you need to get, you can hear the conversation. You right?
Oh no! Across the street.
In the bedroom, close the door. In the bathroom, close the door.
I can't deal with this right now. You're not putting yourself in a position where I can be around you, so I'm going to leave. I can't do anything else because I'm too busy. And if you have the stove on where you can't handle it, you will most likely have to go into the other method of you know, the child having trouble getting to the booster seat where you're not going to be able to. Right now, you most likely will have to hang up the phone and say, I'm going to have to call you back. That is a normal thing. Anyone here who has children, and we all do, know I can't have certain conversations during certain times of the day. It just doesn't work. And it should be able to work. You should have a child who's able, if you say, I'll be with you in 5 minutes, or I need a couple minutes, whatever it is that's a responsible thing and that they can handle, they should be able to do. But if they can't right now, then it's a matter of you have to hang up and deal with them. And then it's a matter of, now we need to put our collective head together and say, well, what then is a logical response to the fact that I needed to be on the phone, and I couldn't, and I needed to call the person back because you were stressing me out with your question. That's a tough one, and I'm totally honest. Like, that's a real hard one. Like, what's the natural consequence for that?
Because at that point, he's one.
So you're talking about the really little kid?
Well, no, I'm not, okay.
Oh, I mean, he's one, and he's
Victoria. I've got Jordan, who's four, and I've got Taylor, who's two.
Right.
So, and Jordan gets the logic of a lot of things that he may not need to be getting it for, but he does.
Mm-hmm.
So, at that point, if I've now hung up the phone because he's pulling on my skirt the whole time and not letting me talk on the phone, and I then actually say to somebody, I mean, this is just like giving him the cookie. Like, how many times does he have to nag before I'm actually going to put up the phone?
Well, what happens when you hang up the phone?
Well,
he's straight into his room.
It doesn't matter that he's gone straight into his room because he's still gotten my attention. He's accomplished what he wanted to do, which was to get me off the phone and to pay attention to him. Even if it's a negative attention, this is what I struggle with, because I feel like if I put down the phone, he's now gotten, even if it's the negative attention, he's gotten my attention. He's gotten me to stop doing what I needed to do without him.
Yeah, but then he's removed from the arena. He's not part of anything anymore. If you then drop him off in his room, and he doesn't get any attention, or he's just carried into his room.
I drop him off in his room, and I say, Jordan, that's unacceptable behavior. This is not the way,
you're lecturing.
I'm lecturing.
Yeah.
Okay. So what do I do?
I'm so sad that you're not able to be in the kitchen with me right now. I wish you could be here. I see that you're not ready to be here.
But him being in the kitchen, he doesn't want to be in the kitchen with me. He wants my attention.
Yeah, he wants to be in the kitchen with you. That's where you are, right?
No, it doesn't. I'm on the couch on the phone.
Wherever you are is where he wants to be.
Okay, so I bring him into his room and I say, I'm so sorry that you're not. And within 30 seconds, not even, he's going to say to me, I'm sorry, Mommy.
Great.
I'll be better. And he comes
excellent.
Back out.
That's the goal.
And then what happens? I make the phone call.
100%. 100%.
And then he starts making
a good friend who doesn't care that you keep paying the phone.
Huh? 100%. You're
going to
get a lot of calls.
100%. In other words, the plan is we set up the policy, we set up the procedure for the home, we wait for them to not live by that because they're four and they can't. They get a natural response, well, you can't be in the play. I'd love to have them to play while I'm on the phone and you could be here, I could watch you, but I can't have you here like this. He goes back to them, when you're ready to come back out and play nicely while I'm on the phone, I'd love to have you. Comes back out and it's mommy, 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 mommy. I'm sorry, I have to go. And it's back in. That's not where he wants to be.
But how many times do you do that? You can have a child
I hasn't been my experience. If that where it's going to be this where he can't. I mean, what would happen is then it's up in the ante where he then can't come back out.
Okay.
Where he can't come back out.
We've tried that with the time just silently.
Right.
And you can do it 50 times, but they eventually get the. If you stick to it,
eventually
they will. If you're firm about it, you will get it.
But for how long?
It sometimes takes time. It does require being firm. In other words, when you give up that one time, that's the slot machine. If you then let him back in, we're just training him that my words don't mean anything. And eventually, you'll get it. How many times do you need to play the slot machine until you get it? Well, the child's going to keep going because he knows eventually he'll get it. So it is a matter of being firm and being patient that it takes time to inculcate that this is the way the procedure works. And it takes creativity. A lot of times there's a lot of creative work that goes into coming up with something that makes sense for the situation. I don't think it would go on for all that long. It might be that one day, 3-4 times, and then again another day. But that's what it takes. I mean, especially because most of the time we're unlearning previous behaviors in which we've taught them that. And again, our children are not malicious. They're just learning the world around us. They learn that how we respond to them. They learn what it takes to get our attention. And if we want to change that and teach them, no, when I say dinner time, I'm only saying that once, maybe twice is reasonable, and that's it. I'm not going to run after you. And it presents a sense of calm to us as parents to be able to have. I'll give you an example. Getting late. This Friday night, all of our company canceled before Shabbos started. So by Thursday, we knew it was going to be just us. It was like a treat. We're looking forward. It's going to be just the family, the kids around the table. All these beautiful scenes. We're going to be singing together. It's going to be amazing. It's going to be great. So we come home from shul, and before I even finish Shalom Aleichem, I'm in the dining room looking at the playroom, and one of the boys is playing a tennis ball, and it rolls away from him, and the other boy picks it up. And the one who was initially playing with it runs over and just mauls him into the floor for having touched his tennis ball. So what's the response? What's the response? I see you're not ready to play with tennis balls. I'm so sorry. I wish you could play with them. I'm going to take them away for a few minutes until you tell me you're ready to play with the tennis balls again. Fine. Everyone's fine. Child is mauled, gets right back up. He's okay. You're going to learn that's not how we handle it when your brother picks up the tennis ball you were playing with. You can't play with tennis balls. Everything is great. But this child decides that that was a totally inappropriate response. I mean, by the way, your children will never say to you, wow, you must have gone to a parenting seminar. Great tactic, Dad.
When they get old enough.
Old enough, not yet. Great tactic. That really was great. That was smart. Good move. I like that one. They're not going to do that. They're going to try harder to find a new way to get under your skin. That's what they're going to do. So this child decided that he wasn't really impressed with my skill of just simply removing him from the tennis ball because he wasn't. And he goes off into a corner and starts pouting. Now, that doesn't bother me. That's fine. No problem. We sit down for Kiddush, and my dream Shabbos is already not going to be here because one of the children is crying off in the corner. Now, what I would have done would have been to go over and to try to convince him to come back and to fight with him and to plead with him. The Shabbos again.
He kept sending messages with the other kids.
Right? So, right. Tell him
tell mommy,
that
tell
I'm
mommy that I need to
really
in this corner.
Right. Right.
In the corner in between the two couches, and I'm going to be here until you check on me.
Right. Totally uninterested. Rifki and I do not even give him a second thought. We played inappropriately.
How much we missed him really well.
Right, how much we'd love to have him around. He's making the decision not to join us. Now, would we as parents love to have all the children around us? Our first Shabbos together, who knows how? That would be great, but you know what? We'll be fine.
That's guilt.
Huh?
That's guilt, isn't it?
No, I'm saying, would we? What's the guilt?
No, to be saying that. I mean, he's sitting there listening to, we would, as parents, are you saying that?
No,
I'm saying, I'm saying.
Oh, we really think that. We'd feel great if you can do that.
I'm saying, why, I'm not going in there to get him, even though I'd like for him to be there. That's his choice. I didn't do anything wrong. Totally comfortable with my decision to take away the tennis balls. He wants to go hide in the corner and cry. That's his decision. Totally fine. Now, the kids also know that the only way that you get grape juice, the rule is, if you're at the table for Kiddush, you get grape juice. If you're not at the table for Kiddush, you don't get it. I'm not calling more than once that it's time for Kiddush. And if you don't want to have grape juice, that's totally fine. When the kids get 7 or 8 years old, they come because they're old enough. But the 3 and 4-year-olds, I'm not fighting with the 3-year-old to come to the table for Kiddush. You want grape juice? That's the rule. Stop making Kiddush, and guess who shows up? My 5-year-old comes right in, gets his grape juice, and goes back to his corner to pout. It's fine, no problem. We go in and we wash. And we sit down for the meal, and because it's just the kids and they're coming, we bring out all of the kids' parsha sheets and the stuff, and we're reading through everyone's. And we start hearing from the corner that we should be reading his, what about his? So, I have to be at the table to get your your parsha sheet read. So it goes on for a little bit, and soon enough, lo and behold, child shows up, sits down, eats his soup, and has his parsha sheet read. So on the one hand, everything is great because it all worked out in the end. I never lost my cool, even though I had a child screaming in the corner, or pouting in the corner, and so it was fine. He eventually says, Mom, you know why I was so sad? So he says, why? So I'm thinking, great. Here's where he's going to have learned his lesson, that he made all the decisions because Daddy was so mean and he took away my tennis balls. Like, what? That's not it. That's not it at all. That's not what happened. It says here that you're supposed to learn that you made bad decisions, and that's...
You get it.
It's very good. So my point in sharing this is that even if it doesn't necessarily seem to work...
Wait. Yeah.
So what happened? That's it. So we said... Oh, I'm so sorry. And whenever I don't know what I was saying, but you know, you said obviously. I think Rifki either redirected it and said, "Oh, I mean, you weren't playing with your tennis balls nicely, and Daddy took them away, or something like that." Like, yes, I took them away, but it was because. But he didn't see it. He did not catch it. That was because he mauled his brother for the tennis ball. That's why. That, maybe he wasn't letting on. That certainly is not what came out. So I just share that. I don't care. It's nice that eventually they'll learn that there's a responsibility, that there's ramifications for decisions, and that they're in charge, and they make the decisions, and they make the decisions to when they're ready to come back out and how they're going to handle themselves. But even if they don't learn it, I know how I'm going to handle a situation that's not going the way that I want it to go. And whether they get it or they don't get it, I am going to remain calm. And even if I can't figure it out now what I'm going to do, one of the great responses is, oh, Mom and I are going to have to talk about this. I'm not sure what's going to happen yet. We'll figure it out. I don't have anything. I don't know what's going to be. I don't know how I'm going to handle this one. I don't know what's going to be a normal, responsible consequence, natural consequence. I don't know, but I'll stall for time. I don't have to know right now. I'm gonna have to think about this, and I'm not sure what's going to happen. You know. Okay, there's a lot more, but let's leave it for this. This is just a basic premise. Well, let me just take a question, and I'll let you out before it gets too late. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, as I'm listening to this, I'm curious about, like, do you just like handle everything or prioritize? I mean, I'm writing homework, bedtime, brushing teeth, interrupting, hurting baby, picking nose, drawing on. This goes on.
Yeah, you know, you gotta tackle one thing at a time. Most children at their certain ages, you know, you can't do it all at once. You really can't. But there's a, you know, whether or not. There's a certain harshness to this approach in that in order to learn the lesson, they're going to actually deal with the consequences. Now, as the children get older, those consequences get much worse. You know, a child who breaks a vase because he told them not to play ball in the house and the vase breaks, guess who pays for that? Guess who has to figure out a way to make money to be able to pay for that? So as the children can get older, they can learn responsibilities. Now, 3 and 4 year olds don't really do that yet. As they get a little bit older, they can. So, but they can only you can only deal with that. Now, we're going to tackle bedtime now. We're going to tackle bath time. But you can't take it all at once. But there's whatever you're going to be working on, and then it's a consistent and it's a firm, and that these are the policies, these are the rules, and I'm not going to get flustered when you don't abide by those. I don't expect you to. You're a child. This is about learning. But you're going to learn what it means when you don't abide. The only one who loses is you and not me. Even though sometimes you feel like you're cutting your nose and you do lose, that's where the energy comes in parenting, and that's where we'll talk more about that, is coming up with things that it really is a child who at the end of the day, he's the one who has to deal with it, not necessarily you.
How do you suggest prioritizing something that the child needs to learn the most that would benefit them, or something that drives you crazy?
Probably drives you the craziest, so that you'll have more energy to deal with everything else.
A family meeting, like say, all right, kids, this is the rule: no grape juice if you don't sit at the table. Like, tell them the rules now.
Yeah.
Like, if we have new rules, we need to enforce.
Yeah, 100%.
So
you don't have to make it so formal. It's just a matter of, you say at the table the first time that you're about to make, your husband's about to make Kiddush, simply tell them, anyone who's at the table, you know, don't say in a way that you don't, whoever's at the table for Kiddush gets Kiddush.
So sort of announce the rule before
Yeah.
maybe.
100%.
And then, I guess what Robin's saying is, like, if you're all of a sudden changing the rule,
let them know.
Should it be something where you say, you know, Mommy and Daddy and I have discussed
that's totally fine. 100%.
Now, you know,
yeah. And then expect them not to come to the table the first week and be prepared to honestly be sad over the fact that you can't give them grape juice. Like I really wanted to give you grape juice. And then be prepared that they're going to throw a fit and that you're still never going to give them grape juice that night. There is no way they're getting grape juice that night, even though they're going to throw a fit. Then what happens when they throw a fit is, I'm so sorry you can't stay at the table with us. I would have loved to have had at the table for the Suda with us, but there's no screaming. We can't have screaming children at the table. When you're ready to come join in, and they'll come back, they'll be sad they miss the grape juice, but next week you won't have the problem.
Doesn't there also have to be limitations on the parents who, like, sometimes they feel like, especially with the phone option, is the 20 minutes we spend on the phone, most likely that conversation could have been 5 minutes, and we get carried away for 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And
then what happens after the conversation?
Yeah, and then we get onto another conversation,
sure,
the phone rings again.
Yeah.
And that's our fault. That's not their fault,
yeah,
that we are sitting there taking conversation after conversation. So of course they hate the phone.
Right.
Of course they think that it's taking our time away from them.
Yeah,
I try to turn off the phone for that whole dinner bed routine.
And I just don't answer the phone.
Yeah. No, what I'm saying, that's an excellent point. That's why did they magically start tugging on your skirt when the phone
rings? You're not fair for us to then sit there like you're punished because you keep fetching. You know, no, it's my fault. Well, I did that. I'm the one who keeps taking your...
Within reason.
Yeah,
so
well, no, you're right.
You should be able to have a phone conversation. Like, there's times when I leave work early.
Like, within reason.
Right, but, within reason, but the point is that, like, if it's not always, then it's not, then how do they know you're sending them a mixed message? Because one is it an important phone call that you should be taking
versus one
that you're
not. But I think
not.
It's on the parents as well to look at their actions and recognize what's an important phone call and what's not an important phone call. And yes, maybe one's work, but because I took four phone calls that weren't work and then one was work, how can I expect my child to then respect that one is important versus the other four that weren't? So you have to, like, implement 100%. That in yourself to be consistent so you're not compensating it by the way.
So one thing you haven't addressed at all is the idea of positive reinforcement.
Yes.
Wondering what.
Yeah. Okay. In other words, I want to. That's why I said I hinted at the beginning. This is an approach which is addressing problems. How do I handle a situation where my child's not getting dressed in the morning, not getting into the car seat? I need an approach to handle that. In subsequent weeks, I want to address that, which is a whole other approach of just how I should regularly be interacting with my child to create that the positive reinforcement.
At the same time, you have to obviously meter out the positive reinforcement because you don't always want to be saying,
yes,
if you do this, then
100%.
It will be something.
I got the threat. Yeah, but you only want a threat. In other words, in the same way as the negative consequences, the natural consequences, so when you get to catch your children doing good things also and play that up. I want to preface that this is really just focusing on the moments that are the most hair-pulling of the day, of when I feel like I lost control of my home, I don't know how to handle it, how do I maintain my calm when that's gone? Let me just conclude with a couple of phrases, and then you'll tell me how it goes. We'll try them over the work. In other words, when you have a child speaking to you with attitude or crying, catching, you're like, I'll be happy to speak with you when you talk nicely to me. I'll be happy to listen to you when you speak nicely. And you say, well, I can't listen to you. And when you're ready, put it on the child's problem. When you're ready to talk to me nicely, I'll be ready to listen to you. That works at 2, at 4, at 20, whatever, the rolling of the eyes, whenever that starts, at 9 or at 10. When you're ready to talk to me nicely, I'll be ready to listen. Put it on the child's head to get themselves in that position. And the last thing that I would just throw out is a lot of different examples in which I always am offering, would you like me to help you or do you want to do this yourself? I had a child in the bathtub, I want to get him out and towel him off. He's not finished. Would you like me to help you do this now or do you want to do it yourself? Because if you don't want to come out now, I'll leave the towel here and you'll do it yourself. Guess how much longer that's going to take, and guess who's not going to get a book that night for sure if he goes with that option. That only has to happen a couple of times, then he'll take the help. Struggling getting the pajamas on, running around the room, not picking up his foot to get him in. I'm not going to lose myself over this. I'm here to help you. Would you like me to help you, or do you want to do this yourself?
And just to clarify, when you do, if you're going to use this method, should you say, you're welcome to stay in the bathtub, but you're not going to have a book?
Yeah, until a certain... Bedtime is at 7 o'clock. I'm happy to help you now. If you want to do it yourself, you can. And I wouldn't say that much because then I would just come back 10 minutes later and then you just pick the child up and say, we're out of time now.
I'm saying, though, at the initiation of the cause, you know, the consequences, should you... I mean, if you're dealing with a child who can understand the cause and effect, should you say...
look, if you're not getting into our car now, then we aren't going to go get ice cream. And then when it doesn't happen, you don't get the ice cream. Should you set that up right at the very beginning?
Sort of like a kiddish example.
Yeah, you could set it up by telling them that these are, in other words, yeah. No, that's a fair thing to set up. These are the ground rules. That there's not much time we have. If he knows how to tell time, you have a clock with a 7 o'clock is better than whatever time it is. So then you don't have to do it as much because you can go back at whatever point. If he never gets out on his own, just put him in his room and lo and behold, it's already 6:58. You didn't have to do it. Let it the situation taught it itself without you having to. The less you have to impose yourself and get the same result, then stay out of it. Why do you have to be the bad guy?
You addressed next week the issue of the aftermath of those situations that you create.
Yeah, so the homework would be...
They have the worst week of their lives.
I don't think so. The homework would be to choose one or two areas and to see what happens, and then we'll talk about it. We'll see what happens tomorrow, next week. As to what worked, what didn't work, and you make the adjustments. Not everything will work for the same kid, for the same parents. Different kids will work differently, and see what worked, what didn't work, and make the adjustments. And this is really just, in itself, if you were to take just a love and line, it would be 4 or 5 weeks just in this approach, and this is just an hour of starting it. But this is just a starting process, and we'll go over it, and we'll keep moving with it. But it's a great approach just for handling the moments of crisis, how you're going to handle it. All right, have a great night, and I look forward to hearing back comments, feedback, whatever.